Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulus Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project Movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
I'm a shot in the dark, very short of spark.
Welcome back to The Whaley Show. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go. Episode 11. Oh, man. It's been a decent... Well, okay, it's been a brutal week. It's been... I'll say for honesty. Well, it's been a decent week for how brutal it's been. No, my life is actually going semi-okay for the most part. Things are getting done. Things are moving forward. But obviously, there's craziness happening in the church and in society and stuff right now that is affecting me, of which we will probably end up discussing at some point. I used to be like, okay, I'm not going to talk about Trump today. I'm like, I'm not going to talk about the sex abuse scandal. And I have a whole section on the sex abuse scandal. It just is what it is. You know, there's no reason to not discuss the giant elephant in the room and the elephant in my life at the moment. So I'm trying not to fall into the habit of making every single show about that. Mom is doing well. The mom report, mom's doing well. She's getting things going. They came today and talked to her, started the process to getting her a motorized wheelchair so she can get around the house when no one's home safely and more easily. And mom is now officially on Team Ultra. I'm so excited. I got mom some Ultras, the same running shoes that I've been wearing. Shout out to Justin Schneer, Drink, and Michael Miley. Maybe I should make Michael Miley part of the, I don't mention the artist formerly known as my former best friend, Kevin, as often as I used to. So it would, you know, maybe I mentioned Michael a lot. Maybe he should be the new Drinking Game. We'll talk about this. I need to come up with a whole new Drinking Game. I need to just kind of come up with the version 2 of the Drinking Game for the show. Anyway, so shout out to Justin and Miley for turning me on the Ultras. I love mine. And I got mom a pair. Mom needed some solid walking running shoes. And these are nice and wide. They have good stability, zero drop. You know, I got her the kind that are not too padded so you can still feel the ground. And I found them. They're like $120 shoes. I found them for like $40 online. Thank you, Sierra Trading Post Clearance. So if you go to sierratradingpost.com and plug in the coupon code The Whaley Show, you'll get absolutely nothing because they are not a sponsor of this show. That was a free advertisement for them. But she's just turned the corner, you know. We're getting some increased feedback, independence on her part, and feedback. She's always giving me feedback. Some increased independence on mom's part. And, you know, I was even able to go out a couple times. We've got to the point where if my caregiver knows to set a couple things up and we make sure she gets a dinner before she goes, I don't have to go home. Mom can put herself to sleep. Mom can put herself to bed, which if I had the opportunity. So if I wasn't a big old fat guy and I didn't live in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, I would have a chance. So you're saying there's a chance. I would have a chance at a social life. But alas, no, I actually am getting back into the barest brushes of what one could possibly call a social life. For starters, shout out to Tanya Kenyalosi from Denver, Colorado, former parishioner at Holy Protection and Mother of God. That's right, Hopro Mogo, home and dwelling place of the good Frollo, the good Father O'Loughlin. She coincidentally, maybe, I don't know, providentially, who knows, moved from Denver, Colorado, just like I did, to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. I guess she has family here. She got a little house. She's retiring here. And I hadn't seen her yet. So we killed two birds, one stone, and I met her down at Ebb and Flow, which is Ebb and Flow Fermentations, which is the new project from Dwayne and April Schaff, owners and the genius behind Celebrations Restaurant here in town. Dwayne Schaff, I mean, shout out to Dwayne Schaff. Dwayne is one of the best chefs I've ever known. He's a master brewer, a coffee roaster, an appreciator of all kinds of obscure indie music, a reader of fine literature and comic books and all kinds of articles and stuff. He's just, I mean, I always say about Dwayne that his superpower is that he's German. His idea, my idea of a good afternoon is like laying on the couch or in bed, like watching Netflix and doing nothing, maybe drinking some wine. His favorite thing to do in the world is work. Like his idea of a day off is, oh, we went out to the farm and we got a bunch of elderberries and we cleaned them and we processed them into elderberry syrup and we canned them and we put them up and now we're going to have elderberry syrup for the whole year. It was a fun Sunday afternoon. So, I mean, he already had one successful small business. They opened a second one now because he was just bored, I think. Now, he's been dreaming of this forever. And what Ebb and Flow Fermentations is going to be is, I'm kind of stoked on this. This is, for this town, this is going to be one of the geekiest, seriously legit breweries in America, maybe the world. And it's in this little town I'm in. Now, I can't really drink much beer. I can only have like a little taste and stuff because of a health condition. But he brews the weirdest, coolest, amazing, like particular beers. He's got he collects yeasts and stuff. He's got yeast, like rando, like obscure yeast from like some tiny monastery in the middle of Belgium or something, or some weird village outside Oslo or something. He's got yeast that like 22 people on Earth own. And he shares them and stuff. You'll see him like tagged on Facebook with like cool brewing projects in Europe talking about they used his proprietary yeast blend or something that he combined to three or something like that. It's like I don't know if they blend yeast. I think they do. I don't know. He's got something, a yeast that he had. I don't mean to cast them. Maybe it's only all single yeast brews. I don't know. I know in the coffee world, blending can be kind of like, speaking of coffee. Ah, I faked you out. That's yerba mate. I had a lot of coffee this morning, so I'm trying to kick the yerba mate in the afternoons. So I went out and so the other thing about Ebb and Flow Fermentations here in Cape Girardeau is that it is in a building that back in the day was Molly's Cafe and Bar. Now Molly's was like in the 80s and 90s, I guess like in the early 90s. and I'm thinking about like in the late 90s, especially, it was like in a town full of bars that were nothing but like bad Bud Light on draft with some crappy, you know, cover band playing for a bunch of dudes in mullets or something. You know, this was like an actually cool restaurant, like a really one of the first fine dining establishments in this town. And when it kind of shut down, they left the bar open and kind of all the cool kids would go. And it was kind of the first place that I went, one of the first places that I felt kind of at home and like kind of cool. And there was big conversations and people that didn't fit in were kind of hanging out, smoking clove cigarettes and, you know, drinking wine and stuff. I found kind of my semi subculture and kind of the less crazy party culture there when I was a young man, doing evil in this world. Well, not quite evil, but not exactly always the good either. In a skinnier, younger, cooler, more grunge like time, I was there. Anyway, so I love this space. It's one of the most beautiful buildings in Cape. I think it maybe is my favorite building in this city, and it has a lot of great old architecture here. And my friend has recaptured this space and turned it into a place that I want to hang out. So I'm kind of full circle. I'm kind of stoked on it. Full circle. All right. So the other thing about, big shout out to Tanya, because Tanya has played a beautiful role for me. Tanya moved here from Denver, and I moved here from Denver. And I felt kind of trapped by moving here because I had to come here because my mom was sick. I didn't want to come here. I've tried to escape here several times. I would escape again if I could. I've seen me do it. But I can't. And so I felt kind of trapped. And in Tanya moving here from Denver and seeing things, and she's seen things and doing things and appreciating things and writing about things on Facebook that I used to love about this place that I forgot that I loved, that I can't see anymore. And now I see it kind of through her eyes. So her fresh eyes on my kind of home has kind of picked up my spirits a little bit. So massive shout out to Tanya Cagnolosi and her ability to experience reality and tell me about it. So speaking of Cape Girardeau, what's going on, Missouri? What's going on? Okay, we're about to get into the part of the year that doesn't suck. I mean, pardon me. I think I got a little bit of a sniffles or something coming on. I've been coughing a little and got a little something there. My favorite time of year, the only time I really miss Missouri is in the fall. Let me try to explain this. In the fall, it is not cold, but it's not hot. And here's the most important thing. It is not humid. Your options in Missouri are freezing and your skin drying out, or sweating through your clothes if you walk across the street. Those are the options. It's like it has two seasons, dry and dead, wet and moldy. It's like Chicago. They say Chicago has two seasons, winter and construction. You know, we have crack skin, sweat through shirt. Those are the two, except for fall. We have three, and fall is the third one. Fall here is glorious. It cools down nice and crisp. Fall is the only time in Missouri that it feels kind of like, you know, Southern California for a while. A little cool at night, nice during the day, no humidity. It's like everything's air conditioned. And when you grow up never having traveled and you don't realize that there are places that it can be July and nice, you just wait for fall. And when fall happens, you are so stoked. And I don't know, just my personality, where fall is like, I love fall colors. I'm an autumn, you know. I love fall colors. I love hunter green and burgundy and, you know, dark grays and stuff. I love those like kind of moody dark colors and like the and these bright reds and all, and you know, kind of everything's muted but bright. It's like the whole world is decorated in my favorite colors. I get to wear clothes again because I've had to be like near naked all summer to keep from sweating to death. So I get to actually wear like, you know, clothes and put a sweater on or jacket or something. It's great. And you sit outside by a fire and you're not hot. It's amazing. Fall is incredible. I'm a giant fan of fall. In fact, I missed fall when I moved to California. But see, here's the cool thing about California, especially Ventura County. If you miss fall, you can get in the car. And you just go out through Ojai, out the it's the 33. Go out the 33, you start climbing, and you keep climbing until it's fall. And then you hang out in fall for a while. And then when you're done with it, you come home. If you're missing winter, just drive farther. And you get up there far enough, and it's like, hey, look, there's snow. There's winter. Yay. It's great. You can always find what you want. And then when you're done with it, you go, let's get out of here. Let's go surfing. And you just drive back down the mountain, and you go get some tacos. It's perfect. It's absolutely amazing. So fall is coming, which means there's signs all over the place right now for check-in. And school's going to be back in. My office, and soon to be my new office down the hall, is right across the street from my campus. So this town will start feeling kind of like semi, sometimes a little bit, a college town again. Which I love college towns. And this one is always kind of in this perpetual struggle to try to figure out how to be a college town. I always say that it's a small town that grudgingly accepts the university within its boundaries and consoles itself with the increase of sports. But it's getting better. It's happening. It's kind of like, in, you know, compared to it being like a ghost town that was humid fall, kids with backpacks. I'm a fan. And daily mass a block and a half from my office again, and more options on Sunday mass. And, yeah, so got some things, I got some plans going for the fall. Try to hit daily mass more. I think we're going to start a school community from Communion and Liberation here in town. So, things are looking up in that regard. So speaking of my relationship to, my home, not today, but the last time I talked to my spiritual director, I just got done talking to my spiritual director, and I'm super processing what he said, because he said something kind of dropped a bomb on me. Shout out to him. Kind of like noticed something and challenged me on something. I was like, that did not occur to me, dude. oh, so many Lebowski references, so little time. My spiritual director says to me that I should focus on the good that I have here and try to make things beautiful here and focus on what I have here instead of wishing I was someplace else and wishing I could have the good someplace else, you know? In fact, the way he said this to me was he told me that he wanted me to beautify it, to make my office beautiful. And he knows me pretty well. It's kind of the same thing as cleaning my room. God has told me to clean my room in prayer before. Cleaning your room is a good place to start. See, it's funny how God says that and everyone likes it. Jordan Peterson says it and no one likes it. See, going back to the last podcast. I'm not saying Andrew Whaley went on his podcast and he said that Jordan Peterson was God. Yep. I did. That's exactly, you're right. You heard me correct. That's exactly what I said. You just go tell your friends that. No, I didn't. So it's funny, you know, I'm just going to ruminate for a second on things that I love about this place. And two things that I decided I love about this place. One of them is long country drives nearby. When I was living in Denver, I used to want to go for a drive. But you would drive for a while and you're still in Denver. And you drive a little farther and you're still in Denver. And then you keep going and you're still in the middle of damn Denver. So it's like I would leave and drive all the way south and there I am. So I go to the west and I'd still, well, now great, I'm in Littleton. And then you finally get to the edge of town and you're like, well, God, it's time to go home. You know, one thing I love about a smaller town, a college town, you can usually drive 5 minutes in any direction and you're in the country. I sometimes need to be the only one on an old road driving as slow or fast as I want without paying attention and just driving and thinking and looking at beautiful scenery. And Missouri is gorgeous, even in the summertime, through the windshield. The windshield covered in dead bugs because there's so many bugs here. No, but you clean the windshield before you go and you keep it clean with the windshield wipers and the vast amount of windshield wiper fluid you go through. And you, I see I'm trying here, but it's not really working. No, you go for the, I love going for these long country drives, these beautiful green scenes and everything. And pretty soon, those are going to be trees turning. My tree in my yard. That is my mom. There's a tree that's like three times the size of my mom's house right next to the house. And it's already starting to kick off some yellow leaves in the middle of August. Who'd have thunk it? So, country drives. I'm a giant fan. Speaking of country drives, two other things I'm super thankful for around here are two small businesses. One is American Grass-Fed Beef. You can go check them out online. They're like a national company that all kinds of paleo people buy, you know, grass-fed beef and stuff from American Grass-Fed Beef. But they are the same company or like some way aligned with Fruitland American Meat, when, and they basically pack and ship this beef all for all that goes all over the place. It goes all the Whole Foods up in St. Louis and stuff. I think they sell some stuff at Chipotle and stuff. And I mean, their processing plant and the place where they have a butcher shop is like, I don't know, 5 minutes from my house. So I go over there and I can buy really fresh, amazing, killer grass-fed beef for prices that would make Denver blush. I mean, like cheap, really great prices on, especially things like marrow bones and stuff. That I think I buy grass-fed local organic marrow bones for 99 cents a pound. They're like 17 something at Whole Foods in Denver, and that's not even grass-fed. If you go over to like Western Daughters and it's like $20 or something for, I mean, I can't afford to make stock out of that. I was just always making chicken stock all the time. I can make beef stock and I can make delicious beef soup and stuff out of it this fall, pretty soon, when there's leaves on the trees that are look pretty. I'm trying to remind myself that fall's coming. But the other business that I love is Family Friendly Farms. Rachel Fosnot and her family have this, this company that used to do, raw milk. I'm not sure if they're still doing it. And they have chickens, which I haven't been out to the farm since I've been home. It's because you got to go out there the first Saturday of every month or whatever, get chickens. I need to start getting out there. But the local health food store, which is a pretty decent little store, has their eggs, and their eggs are, I mean, I have hung out with these chickens. They are amazing. They're just like, this is Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin style, grass-fed rotation farming. And these chickens get moved every day on fresh pasture and they eat bugs and stuff. And it's awesome. And they have eggs and they're like just rich, dark orange, yellow, beautiful, thick, delicious yolks on them. And they're like $4. They're not like $3.89 or something. I mean, these things would cost $12-13 for that kind of local egg, like in Denver or something. So I'm thankful that I can get great meat and eggs here. And so as I was ruminating about this, loving the place that I am and trying to see it through the eyes of love and to move forward with a kind of a belief in providence. And a quote from G.K. Chesterton was brought to my attention by Father Spencer up in Minnesota. He mentioned Pimlico. And so G.K. Chesterton in Orthodoxy talks about a place called Pimlico. And I just want to read this. I want to read this passage to you, and then I want to talk about it a little bit. And then the chatty. This is the transition from chat to muse. This is chatty musy. And then we're going to go from chatty musy to ranty. And from ranty to rant muse, and then to muse. And then it is kind of like random. That's the plan. All right, G.K. Chesterton from Orthodoxy. Let us suppose we are confronted with a desperate thing, say Pimlico. Now, Pimlico, time out, was like this neighborhood in London, and it was like really kind of beige and dreary and banal and just kind of like nothing you would like about it. It was just evidently just like a very, very boring, horrible, banal, rundown place in London, evidently. So, time in. If we think what is really best for Pimlico, we shall find the thread of thought that leads to the throne of the mystic and the arbitrary. You notice how I use this voice when I'm speaking for G.K. Chesterton. It is not enough. That's how he talks. It is not enough for a man to disapprove of Pimlico. In that case, he will merely cut his throat and move to Chelsea. Nor certainly is it enough for a man to approve of Pimlico. For then it will remain Pimlico, which would be awful. The only way out of it seems to be for somebody to love Pimlico, to love it with a transcendental tie and without any earthly reason. If there arose a man who loved Pimlico, then Pimlico would rise into the ivory towers and golden pinnacles. If men love Pimlico as mothers love their children, arbitrarily because it's theirs, Pimlico in a year or two might be fairer than Florence. Some readers will say this is mere fantasy. I answer that this is the actual history of mankind. This, as a fact, is how cities did grow great. Go back to the darkest roots of civilization, and you will find them knotted around some sacred stone or encircling some sacred well. People first paid honor to a spot and afterwards gained glory for it. This is the money quote right here. You ready? Men did not love Rome because she was great. She was great because they had loved her. I love reading G.K. Chesterton and using my Chesterton voice. I should start working on my Chesterton voice. I once used Chesterton as my celebrity doppelganger. I mean, he and I, he was a man of substance like myself. We do kind of look the same. I say that I have a certain, Chestertonian largesse, if you will. So here's the things that I want to point out from that. For the visionary, love is discontent. love and discontent coinciding. Because if you just love Pimlico like it is and you leave it alone, it stays Pimlico. And that's tragic because Pimlico sucks. And then the other thing is that if you hate Pimlico and you refuse to do anything about it, you just cut your throat or leave. Like he said, you just ditch, you know. But things only become great, and someone only changes when someone loves something despite itself and acts in that way. Then something can change. So I need to look at where I am like it's Pimlico. And the other thing I came away from this is I kind of want to be somebody's Pimlico. You know, I mean, I admit that there's no reason to there's no real reason to love me, but I kind of want to be loved so I can flourish. You only flourish when you're loved, you know? So if you're interested in loving me so I can flourish, then just send me an email. That was both charming and desperate. You know, it's interesting. There's this book. I've talked about it before on the show, the old show. Hold on, slurp. You only get the one big slurp for traditional purposes. There's a book called The One Thing You Really Need to Know. And it's by, who's it by? Marcus Buckingham. The same guy that wrote, the book, he wrote the original StrengthsFinders book with Donald O. Clifton. And he talks about the one thing you really need to know about personal success. The one thing you really need to know about, being a great manager, and the one thing you really need to know about being a great leader. And the thing that he talks about what the leader is the leader is the person who is always discontent. And they could come off as kind of, they could be really jerky about it. They can come off as kind of like never happy or whatever. You know, you could become Steve Jobs and just like have a reality distortion field and just you berate people when they don't live up to your ideals or whatever, but don't do that. But the leader, he feels in his person, one could argue that he is, his identity in his person is the fundamental delta between the way things are and the way things could be or the way they should be. He lives kind of a perpetual what if. He sees the potential in everything, but they can become very dark. I mean, I have this personality become very dark because they can't see what's good and worthwhile and good enough about any place or anything. They only see the potential and it haunts them and it frustrates them, you know? But it's interesting that Chesterton seems to say that acted upon is what can change anything, change any place. Which is good. I mean, at least if you're in the place changing business, and then it's good to have that. And I am in the place changing business and the place creating business and the context creating business. And I have that personality. I need to get a cough button or something. So the thing is, and then I want to move on here. I've been kind of getting the itch. I swore I wasn't going to do another space here. I wasn't going to do a retail shop. I wasn't going to do anything. I'm kind of getting the itch. I miss being behind the counter. And my old vision for this place that kind of evolved and became other things over time in different places is beginning to reemerge a little bit, and some insights and some things that I thought were important about what I was called to do in this world are I'm getting reminded of a little bit. And so I'm starting to, with great happiness and in great fear, starting to think that maybe this is my Pimlico. I hope it's not. Quite honestly, I hope that Ventura County is my Pimlico. I hope that Ventura, California is my Pimlico. But it's probably not. That would be too good. Shout out to everybody. I do want to build something. I really want to build something in Ventura really bad, just so I have an excuse to go back and forth and see all the people I love in this world. All right. So that's the end of that part. The next part is labeled. That was labeled chat. I decided to, you know, chat rant muse is kind of my new tagline for the show. This is a transition. This is the chatty muse. This is just chatty muse, and then it's gonna go into full rant, then we'll see what happens. Okay, now I'm gonna talk about some stuff, and this is something that just kind of occurred to me, and it could get a little dangerous in places, but I really, really, really mean well. So I am fascinated constantly by the big movement behind something, the meta narrative, so to speak, the bigger movement that these little movements are part of that explain them, you know, kind of like, in Ptolemaic astronomy, I think it's in Ptolemy, there's this thing called an epicycle, right? And cause some things are, rotating around something, and you know, they're in orbit around something, and that thing is in orbit around something else. And so if you're standing on a thing that other thing is orbiting, there are times when the thing orbiting you looks like it's going backwards. I call that a retrograde motion and stuff. But sometimes you keep seeing a pattern in these movements. Now, something similar that happens when you start seeing an analogous movement in a bunch of really different unconnected things, right? And so there's a few things that I've noticed about this area that have changed in the last 6 years, and I've been thinking about them, and I started seeing that there is a pattern or a narrative to it, and I'm just want to talk about it for a second, because this is what I do, because you're never going to hear this on any other Catholic podcast, because this is the kind of crap I think about. This is what I think about when I'm not driving down the street going, oh God, what am I going to do with my life? Oh God, why am I me? Why can't I be somebody else? I want to be somebody better. Oh God, why can't I do this? When I'm not doing that in the car, this is what I think of. I don't know why bearing my soul with all of its truthful pain makes me laugh, but it explains a lot about me. Okay. So I have seen, I'm going to tell you about three things. Well, I'm going to tell you about that. I have seen an increase in southernness, so to speak, the southern nature of this part. So I am from, this town is roughly 20, 25 miles north of the Mason-Dixon line. Malone Avenue in Sikeston, Missouri is the Mason-Dixon line. So there has classically been a pretty serious difference between the culture and everything you would see here in Cape Girardeau and what you would see like in Sikeston or South. In fact, that's why the Mason-Dixon line went through there. That's why the north-south divide is right there, right? But that's a little different. But the point being is that was the South. The South starts at Malone Avenue. North is here. And this was literally the part of the country where brother was fighting brother, because we are a river town. There are river boats docking here all the time. There was like all the architecture downtown looks like New Orleans, right? The big steakhouse, the Royal New Orleans. Everything's New Orleans. It looks like New Orleans. In fact, the Royal New Orleans before, now it's a Irish pub, but my friend Jerry Ann once owned it at one point, and she said that it was decorated in a style called Bordello chic. But you know, the big thick red velvet drapes and stuff, and this the big windows, it looks like New Orleans. It's amazing. And a lot of the architecture downtown looks like New Orleans because this city and its economic livelihood was connected to the river and riverboats and the trade that happened between New Orleans and St. Louis and back and forth, right? Mark Twain wrote about this city from a riverboat. Like he talked about how you could see it from the river, and he talked about the college here that you could see from the river back then. So it's a river culture. You go just 20 miles south, they don't have a good connection to the Mississippi. They don't have a port. They don't have a cape or anything. And it was a plantation culture. And it was literally a place. I mean, Sikeston, Missouri is the last place in America, as far as I know, it was the last place in America that a black man was lynched for the crime of being black in the wrong place, the wrong time. Just like, you're black, you're not where you're supposed to be, lynching. And that happened in like 1971, I think. I was alive when this happened. Way after the civil rights movement was over and everything. A man, the last time somebody was strung up in a tree for the crime of being black was a few 20 miles south of here. And you still, when you, and you experience that culture there, it's a very Southern culture. You're in Dixie. Like, you're driving south and you get off the, I mean, it's like grits for breakfast, Dixie accents, the whole nine yards. And, you know, and the demographics are different. The racial demographics are different, right? Because of that context. There's a place in Sikeston called Sunset, and it's within, because you had to be within this neighborhood, within the boundaries of these four streets by sunset if you're black. And if you were caught outside of that part of town, you could be lynched for being outside. And so it became to be known called Sunset, right? So that's just south of here. It's the south, like the old plantation south. I mean, literally watermelon farms, cotton farms, all that. Which used to be, I mean, like poor white people worked on those farms too, man. It was like, I have a family that my dad married into that are from down there, and they grew up picking cotton and picking watermelons and stuff. So, but this is like the college town with the river attached to it up here, you know? So what I've noticed since I've been back is that, and this is the part that might be a little dangerous because you might think I'm griping about this, but the point is that the demographics in Cape Girardeau have gotten dramatically blacker since I've been here. You see more black people than you used to see. And I'm not attaching a good or bad to that. I'm not saying it. I'm just saying you just see more people who are black, right? You see, and at first I thought, you know, well, this is just kind of like, there was gentrification around the New River campus where the old seminary was. The university bought this old Vincentian seminary, and all the neighborhoods around that, around Morgan Oak and Good Hope, around the bridge going over to Illinois, were the classically black neighborhoods. And I thought, well, maybe the university taking over that changed the demographics, and it's classic gentrification. The big, nice apartment buildings that are all new and kind of like these developments are north of the college. And all these old buildings that used to have college students in them, maybe they're opened up, and maybe people that were displaced by this gentrification are moving here. So I just see it around my office and in this part of downtown. But it's in the store. It's in at Walmart. When you go to the grocery store, you just are conscious of the fact that you see a lot more, black people in this area. You know, I remember when I first moved to, after living and going to St. Louis all the time and living in Missouri, when I got to California, and I'd seen California so much on the news and everything, and I got to Ventura and I was like, where are all the black people at? Why aren't there more black people? I was disappointed. I was like, this is just, everyone looks the same, except they're all Mexicans, right? There were literally in Ventura County, there are more Native Americans than there are black people back then. That's actually changed too. So there's these shifting demographics in the United States as people move around and different opportunities and things push them and pull them in different ways. So no big deal. Great. There's been some changes in this area that I evidently don't understand with where people live and all that. And it's, you know, so evidently there's a movement of people that are black from south to north, I'm assuming. Maybe it's from St. Louis down. I'm not sure. It seems like they're mostly coming from farther south of here, moving up to Cape Girardeau. But then I started noticing that there was a deeper connection to kind of the southern culture in other ways. I started noticing that the accents that I encounter on a regular basis are a little thicker. You know, there's a little more of a southern accent than I used to hear here. You used to have to drive a little farther south to hear that heavy of a drawl around here. It's just something that was more subtle. And at first I thought it was just me coming from Denver and not being used to hearing it, but no, it's there. It's definitely. And I started noticing like the stickers on the cars and the brands that are being worn and stuff. And it's like culturally and demographically, this place has shifted slightly farther south, or the south has extended up into this place more accurately. Now here's where it gets weird, because that all makes sense, right? That's just shifting demographics. That's just a change in pop culture. Maybe country music's kind of having its moment. Maybe more people that were raised south of here are moving up to the city and buying a house here or something and raising their family here. Who knows? That's all super explainable and not a big deal. But here's the kicker. Armadillos. There didn't used to be armadillos here. I never saw one. I lived here off and on several times. I've driven all over the place. Armadillos are something that happened down south, way south, like Texas, south, Arkansas and Texas. Not here. And there are dead armadillos on the roadside all over the place. And they've gotten increasingly so, even since I've been home as the summers moved on. I mean, between the place I get on the highway and the place I get off the highway, I saw 4 dead armadillos on the side of the road on the way in today. 4. I'd never seen one before. And mom's like, oh yeah, you see them all the time, you know? And she didn't realize, mom, I used to live here. That's a new thing. You know, she just didn't notice that it was new. But she's had a stroke, so I don't know if she remembers everything. But so I'm like, okay, this is how my mind works. Is there, because armadillos are a creature that doesn't have culture, that doesn't have will or intellect or intention or any of that. And they're moving from south to north, it seems like. Now, how could that be? What would that be about? I'm like, okay, this could just be a coincidence. It could be that for whatever reason, habitat in the south is being taken over and armadillo is being pushed north. Maybe it's climate change. Maybe armadillos are, I didn't do any research on armadillos, but maybe armadillos like a certain mean temperature or whatever. And because of climate change, that mean temperature, that line is moving north. But then that got me to thinking, what if there's something as subtle as like the change in climate could subtly drive in through a million different things, kind of the butterfly effect, a movement of culture to a place where people decide to go to work or buy a house or where they're going to choose to live or something. So all I know is my city, all the little things, the food you see offered, the type of recipes you see advertised, that because they've done their research and that will appeal to the most people here. All those things have become increasingly more southern. And it's just, I don't know. I have no answer. I'm just trying to figure out if there is a broader perspective, and climate is what I came to because I thought, okay, well, there's got to be, it could be one of two things. It could be climate or it could be spiritual in some way, right? There's a shift in the spirit or something, because there has to be something that's context, that's bigger than all of these things, that these things could all fit inside of. Climate is all I could come up with. So it's warm in here, for the record. Speaking of climate change, the climate in my office has changed. And I think the lady that has the office on the end, left for the day and didn't check to see if I was here. And I think she's turned the air conditioning off in the office building because it's getting a little warm. I did open the window though. So I opened the blinds. Let's see if that helps. Hold on. Talk amongst yourselves. I'll give you a topic. Andrew is crazy for talking about this Southern stuff. People are going to misunderstand it, think he's a racist. And the idea makes no sense anyway. Discuss.
Closing the window. Here I go. Closing the window. All right.
All right. Stop talking about me behind my back. I'm just trying to close a window. Gosh, it's so mean. You're catty, mean people talking about me when I'm trying to close a window. All right. So enough with accents and armadillos. I don't have the, you know, a friend of mine and I shot an email to a friend of mine who will not be named. And I asked him if he wanted to do something, this thing that we've been talking about doing. And he said, I don't know, man, the horror is just too horrible. It may take me a few days or a few weeks. I just can't. I'm like, that's kind of where we're all at. So let's dip our toe into the ye olde sex abuse scandal. So the Pennsylvania grand jury document that I've been ranting about, the reports, what it was going to say, came out, and we see what it says, and it's worse than we thought. It's terrible in every way. I was at the gym the other day, and I heard that old Bare Naked Lady song where he says, I'm the kind of guy that laughs at a funeral. Don't understand what I mean. You soon will. I am the kind of the guy that laughs at a funeral. When I'm pissed or just hurt and just kind of like, I don't know what to do and I'm kind of on the edge of kind of giving up, I laugh or I make jokes. And so, don't take my little giggles here as, I'm just like, okay, well, shit, what do we do now? It's like, I mean, it is a train wreck, ladies and gentlemen. It is an absolute train wreck. I'm just like, man. I want to talk about, well, one thing that happened this week that was kind of brutal. I shared a couple podcasts ago that I am a clergy abuse survivor. And I talked a little bit about I put on my big boy pants and manned up and got on the old interwebs and Googled up, the websites with like archives of like this stuff and looked up my priest. And sure enough, there he was. I saw younger than I knew him. And I looked in the face of my abuser for the first time since I was like 14. Cause I was like 12 when this happened, but he didn't die till 85, turns out. And I was around. So, that was fun, you know, going to church with that big guy. But I saw his face for the first time and I read the little file on him and, he abused some kids in St. Louis. So in classic fashion around here in this part of the world, they sent him out as a punishment. They sent him out to the Boones to Immaculate Conception in Flat River, Missouri, or where I grew up in Deloge, Missouri. And he got me. Great. Thanks, St. Louis Archdiocese. Thanks for taking a guy that you knew abused people, putting him through some crappy, fake, ginned up rehab stuff for nervous exhaustion or whatever kind of crap they say, and then sending him to my small town so he could abuse us. We really appreciate that. Thank you. So that happened. Yeah, that's great. And see, here's the problem with that story is that happened like a lot. Turns out it was like really, really normal. Happened a lot everywhere. That's not good. I don't like that at all. And so as I was thinking about this, you know, and I can't do anything about it. It's not like I could sue the Archdiocese now. The statute of limitations and all that stuff is all over. No. Now, what's interesting, though, is in Pennsylvania, they are talking about changing the statute of limitations so that some of these guys who are still alive can be criminally prosecuted. And they're thinking about changing the basically making a 2-year window where people who were scared to come forward kind of in, you know, like everyone's like, you know, all these women with this Me Too, why didn't they come forward? Well, because they didn't want to get crushed. That's why. Or they were ashamed or afraid or whatever. They didn't think anybody would believe them, so they didn't come forward. So they're talking about having a 2-year Oxenfree come forward and we'll let you sue people again. If that happened in St. Louis, I don't know what I would do. I don't know. I have mixed feelings on the situation. I want to talk, though, about how to say it. Two things I want to talk about is the cover up. And I've talked a little bit about this, but I've ruminated on it a little more and I want to talk about it. So this happened. So you're a bishop, you find out, oh, hey, one of our priests or 300 of our priests. Now at the time it would be maybe like a few of our priests over each, you know, area or whatever, maybe more, abuse some kids. All right. That's bad. Ooh, gosh, man, that's the exception, not the rule. We have so many good priests. The church is good. The church is God's body. It's Christ's body on earth. We have the true sacraments and the truth, and we have to defend the church. We have to, okay. So they developed this bunch of methods. Let me see if I can find this real fast while I'm talking. A friend of mine just, posted, I can't find it. I'll have to find it. An article by Rod Dreher, who as an Orthodox and ex-Catholic who has reported on this so much that it was part of why he openly admits as part of why he left and became Orthodox. He just couldn't do it anymore. He has a new article out where he's talking about there was a method that was so well defined that it was even investigated by the FBI. And one of those things was an internal documents and stuff. You don't refer to things like rape or child rape or molestation. You talk about improprieties or inappropriate behavior or boundaries issues. Yeah, I would say having sex with a 10-year-old is definitely a little more than a boundary issue. And they did that so that, you know, if anybody caught wind or saw one of these things, and you never called it that, you tried not to let anybody know that he was being pulled from ministry for a while. You referred to it as nervous exhaustion or just the father needs a break or whatever. They put him in these facilities where they would decide whether or not they were a pedophile, whether this was ingrained in them, basically by asking them questions and believing their own self-reporting. And there's cases of guys who went to bishops and went, look, man, I am a monster. I can't help myself. You need to protect these people from me. And they still didn't take him out of the service. There's a special rung of hell. That's all I'm saying. It's amazing to me. But as I thought about this, it's like, okay, look, I think that John Paul II viewed it this way. This is the charitable way of looking at his actions on how he viewed this, because he's my hero and I love him. He's like, look, there is a civil war going on. This is an attack on the church from inside the church. And we need to basically circle the wagons and defend the church regardless of where the attacks come from. And the devil is having this happen inside the church to attack us, to kill our witness in the world. So we need to not play along. We need to fight. And the fight is to cover and to, you know, and at that time, especially back in the 70s and stuff, the normal kind of like feeling psychologically across the board was like, oh, this isn't as deeply rooted as we think of it now. This is something they're going through. They can be healed the same way that, an alcoholic can kind of come to grips with the reason he started drinking and work the steps and, you know, kind of get over it and be safe to go back and, you know, but it's like safe to do what? Safe to go back and work as a bartender. I don't understand the mentality behind this. I'd say, great, give him a desk job. away from anyone. If you need their work so bad, they could be a janitor at the old folks home or something, you know. They could, or at least make them the chaplain of an old folks home. Don't let them around the kids, you know. But we didn't do that because we were worried about our PR, right? Now, here's the thing, though. In 2000, this is what I talked about before. I want to repeat it, and I want to double down. Back in 2002, when this came out, we were kind of like in this mentality of like the church hates the world, the media is the voice of the world, and we have to defend the church. And so we all went, including me, mea culpa, went into apologetics mode. And we started knocking down their figures and comparing it to the percentages of other things and all this stuff and defending. And no wonder people didn't come forward, because the thing that they were getting out of the church was, oh, it wasn't that bad. And really, you know, most of these people, I mean, if you look at their ages, it really wasn't. And they were kind of building all these arguments. And I was one of them. I did that out of love of the church. Now, here is the part that I haven't talked about. And I'm dead serious. I really am kind of like, I mean, on one side, I'm kind of asking forgiveness for this. But on, I mean, I understand the motive. I didn't talk about, I mean, in privacy, most of my friends, you know, if you drank a few bottles of wine with me, you'd figured out that I'd been touched by a priest or whatever. You mean, it's like, you know, I mean, that it wasn't like something I hid, but I didn't go around writing about it. I didn't confront the diocese. And a couple of times people asked me, why don't you do something about this? Why don't you call that diocese and you could probably get a settlement or something? I'm like, no, man. I mean, they could take that money and use it to spread the gospel or to help the poor or something. I love the church. This was an attack on the church. I don't want to take from the church because a priest took from me. I know the difference between this one old pervert or even a few old perverts and the Roman Catholic Church, that glorious, you know, that company's going through the ages, awful and terrible and beautiful and amazing. Chesterton, rah, rah, C.S. Lewis, rah, rah. Let's go buy some more Scott Hahn books and learn to do apologetics. Rah, rah, rah. That was me, right? And I didn't talk about this, but I didn't talk about it. I think most people didn't talk about it because they were ashamed. I was kind of like, maybe because my abuse was some, I don't know, you can't really evaluate it. I don't know how other people got it, but I've read about people getting it worse than me, you know? And it's like, okay, you know, maybe it was this, I just didn't feel, maybe it's my, as you can see with my, I'm sitting here talking about this on a podcast. I'm kind of a hard on my sleeve kind of guy. There's very little in my life that you don't know about. There's some things. But there's very little that I'm not, if I were freed from all constraint and there's very, very damn little that I wouldn't just put on my sleeve and talk about on this show or publicly. I'm just not that guy. Shame did not keep me from talking. The love of the church and the defense of the church's image kept me from talking. So it dawned on me this week that I, in my apologetics and in my silence, I took two different actions in that way, acting on the exact same motive that bishops used to move predatory priests around and not tell people about it. They put the defense of the PR of the institution ahead of the personal safety and good of the individual human persons that Christ died for. And I did that. I did the same thing. I stayed silent and I did apologetics. I would even talk about the fact that I was abused as a way to do a exclamation point. And by God, I was one of them. You know, I would use that in my apologetics. Makes me sick to think of now. Now look, to cover your mother's shame is an honorable and primal, understandable thing to do. But to cover your mother's sickness from everyone else is a crime. You know what? If my mom was, you know, out of her mind or something, and she was laying in bed with no clothes on, and someone came over to deliver something, I would quickly cover her up with a blanket or something. But if mom was had a bunch of diabetic sores, my mom's not diabetic, but if she had like a bunch of diabetic sores on her legs and her legs were going to end up needing to be amputated, and the doctor came over and I covered her up so he wouldn't see that, and I called it defending my mom, that would be insanity and criminal. That's what we've done. That is exactly what we've done. And I say we in the full sense of the word. If you are a conservative Roman Catholic and you have done a whole bunch of apologetics trying to blame the media for this between 2002 and a few weeks ago, with very well-meaningly, you did it too. If you are listening to this and you are a victim yourself and you didn't come forward, not because you were ashamed and hurt and all that, but because you needed to defend Holy Mother Church, because, you know, we gotta keep fighting this fight, you're guilty too, just like me. So there you go. So two things I want to talk about this now. One thing is we need to put a ban and an embargo on the phrase policies and procedures. If I hear one more damn priest and one more damn bishop on NPR or any other kind of news or something going, well, you know, we really have to put in the policies and procedures, and that we just didn't follow our policies and procedures, and we need to really double down and make sure we have to enforce the proper policies and procedures, and they might as well say like the best practices or the come on. Now is not the time to talk about policies and procedures. The reason that there were 300 priests, 301 priests in three quarters of the diocese of of Pennsylvania. I don't even think Philly is even included in this. I didn't read it. I know Pittsburgh is. I don't think this is the part of the state that includes Philadelphia. Three quarters. So 301 people were out there abusing at least one person, and someone or several people knew about it and didn't do anything about it. The problem was not there wasn't, well, I'd like to report this here pedophile that's having sex with little boys, but, you know, I looked and I don't really see a clear mode of procedure or a clear policy one way or the other. And so I wasn't real sure which of the dicastery offices or which part of Rome I should address the letter to, so I'm just going to go ahead and let them keep abusing kids. No, that was not what happened. Policies and preachers are not the problem. And to even continue using those words is offensive and disgusting. And if you're a good bishop and you've said this, stop it. If there was a guy across the street molesting his daughter, and he did it in an open window where I could see when I went to take the trash out, you know what I do? I'd call 911 and go, hey, there's a pervert hurting a little girl, sirens, handcuffs, pervert behind bars, problem solved. Well, wait a minute. Should you have really called 911? Maybe you're really up for things like that. That's not an immediate emergency. Maybe you're supposed to like look up and call the other number for the police department, not because you know 911 is very overused and you don't want to be shut up. That is not what's going on here. That's how silly that would be. Policies and procedures, please. The other thing that's kind of really shocked me, not shocked me, it was super predictable, but it pissed me off, was the way both the far left and the far right are using this as, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. So the two things I've heard were, it was clericalism and control and the conservatives in the church that keep everything on lockdown who are supposedly pro-life. Everybody was really about the pro-life movement, but they're really not pro-life. If they cared about people, they would have done this. And there is some truth to that, quite honestly. The dirty little secret, though, is that most of the people that we see now who were doing that were the ones that were actually really liberal. Now, there weren't, not all, and we'll get to that. But this was almost exclusively, pardon me a second. Sorry, I have a frog in my throat here. Now, one thing that just you got to point out, there were, I was surprised by how much of it was not, but this was all same sex for the most part, like 90% same sex. There were cases of women getting abused and girls getting abused, no doubt. But most of this was gay men molesting younger men or young boys. Now, you can just exhale telling me, well, that doesn't matter. That's the, you know, no, go the whole older, younger thing long before that was a thing in long before that was like a thing in heterosexual culture and heterosexual porn and all that stuff. It was a hallmark of the gay culture and gay fantasy and gay role playing and gay, all the terms they use and everything was that super part of it. So that's relevant. And most of these guys, when you know who they were, they're the left-leaning bishops, the left-leaning people. Some of them were conservative, left-leaning priests, and then covered up by a conservative bishop, it seems like, because he's trying to defend the church. See my indictment above. PR, this is a war, circle the wagons. Now, the right, I've seen articles coming out of the far right, the traddies in this world, that I'm some of which I'm friends with, and they're saying, see, we've been telling you it was Vatican II's fault. Modernism and Vatican II is a Vatican II. And when we killed the mass and we made it into this monstrosity that created all these monsters, here's the problem. Go look at the two things. A, go look at the grand jury report. It started like in the 40s, in the great old golden age, when you guys said that everything was perfect and amazing, a full damn near 30 years before the crap hit the fan, this was going on. So there were an ocean of priests vested properly in pretty churches that were full of people with a ton of altar boys cranking out the Latin mass ad orientum with smells and bells in Latin and then going and abusing someone. So don't tell me that this was, well, the Latin mass would have fixed all the, no, there were people saying the Latin mass and then going abusing kids. Now, other thing, the right's going to get it twice. Let's see, what allowed all of these gay pervert priests to get to have this smoke screen around them that everyone would trust them and let them do whatever they wanted? It was the clericalism and the weird exaltation of the priest's role to a disordered level, not a reverent level, not a respect and a reverence of the position in his place as the, of Alter Christus, but a weird kind of like power, kind of like trust. You don't question what a priest says, you know, no, a priest said this. This is, you know, it was that good old fashioned, cold, scary clericalism of the pre-conciliar era that was still holding over in the minds of these people that was weaponized. This traditional clericalism was weaponized by these left-wing priests and other priests that were, regardless of what their liturgical or theological take on things was, that was weaponized for the sake of hurting people and using them as objects. So there's a lot, this goes back. And if you read history, this goes back farther, which is something I'm not really ready to talk about on the show. I talked to my spiritual director today about some ideas, and I'm just starting to wonder if, you know, that I've pushed for the option of a married priesthood in the West. I've got some thoughts on this psychologically and sociologically and culturally that I'm kind of letting play out before I want to shoot my mouth off on the podcast, which I've learned something. But anyway, to recap, it's a friggin' dumpster fire. There you go. And I don't know how in the world, I honestly don't know if how the church is going to react to it. As someone who is a consultant that helps the church do mission, if they all decide to circle the wagons and just do whatever they can to just keep their head down and not, then I'm just going to open a shop or a bookstore or something and just, you know, because I'm not going to be able to make a living because everyone's going to tuck their, if everyone tucks their head between their legs and just takes off, then we're, I'm, you know, there's that. And I don't know what's going to happen. I just, I'm not sure where we're going from here. This is different than it was in 2002. There's something that we found out that is worse than we thought it was. And what we thought was fixed wasn't fixed. And there were people in control of the response to this, which, who were abusers themselves. This is not the same as it was. And I'm not the same in front of it. All right. I want to move on to the muse portion, which is related in a sense. I've been taking kind of the way I've fueled this in the last few days, at least. So I've been taken with, because I do this for a living too, I've been taken with, because I literally have clients that I'm working on projects for right now that are like saying, hey, let's push pause and rethink this a little bit. How would we do this now? I think that I've been obsessed with the idea of how we move forward. Do we need to restructure how we do parish? Do we need to restructure how we do the priesthood? I've made a pitch for a married priesthood in the West as an option. How do we move forward doing mission when we are full circle back to an even worse black eye than we had before? How can we certainly can't walk around all proud like we're the conscience of the country anymore, pretending that Christendom didn't fall. But I'm hoping that this could be a severe mercy, to steal a phrase from one of my favorite books title, or a felix culpa, you know, a happy fault. That, you know, the scripture says that God works for the good, all things for those who love him, you know. And God was not sitting around going, all right, things are going pretty well. Yeah, we got a lot more priests now. The young guys are good. The hippies are going to die off in about 20 years. We're going to get back to doing this right. What? Yeah, go ahead. Tell me. What? They did. Oh, come on. Gabriel, get the whiteboard. Bring it in here. Plan B. I did not see this coming. How did you not see it coming? You're God. I mean, it's too hard to explain. I did not see this coming. Okay, that didn't happen. So if God saw this coming and he called us to be missional and he called us to preach the gospel and he called us to live and engage the world with the gospel of Christ, he called us with all that knowing this is the case. And quite honestly, it's been worse. I mean, look at like the Medici papacy and the board. I mean, it's like there were orgies in the Vatican. Well, actually there were orgies in the Vatican City, you know, not too long ago. With drugs. We found out about that too, but that was in the news. But it's been worse. Maybe it hasn't been worse down in the trenches in the small churches, but it's been worse in the institution. And so what could happen? I say that we have been needing for a time to let go of the baggage of Christendom and realize where we're at. And that is, we've kind of had this pretend privilege of us having this special place in our society as kind of like the conscience of the country, or like, you know, but it's been just pretend. It's a pretend privilege because we haven't had that for a while. No one has given a damn for a while about the Catholic Church. No one has cared. If you're a guy in a collar, they weren't like, oh, wow, he's kind of pricking at my conscience about, you know, I should really do it. No one does that. I mean, we haven't been there for a while, but many people have been acting like we still are and building mission, building catechesis, building evangelization, all thinking that still using kind of a hidden presupposition that we're the church. But yeah, right. That pretend privilege has been wrested from our hands. We now officially have to earn the right to be heard. Another thing is that I think there's some false dichotomies that we're going to have to start facing, and this might make us face it, that respect and reverence are some false, not dichotomy. Some of them are false dichotomies. Some of them are like false, you know, things that have to go together, right? You know, false conjunctions. I don't know what I would call it. That respect and reverence for the priesthood is the same thing as clericalism. No, you can have not clericalism. You can have priests be like us and part of us and living as, you know, normal human beings that we know and have over for dinner, and we appreciate them, and we know they're not perfect, and we don't worship them and believe everything they say. We don't have to go back to some weird clericalism to counteract this lack of reverence or whatever. That's not a thing. Another one is a big one, I think, that's hitting the right now. The Catholicity of the church, the universal nature, the universal truth of the church, not being dependent upon culture or time, that it is true and good and beautiful as a representative of the true and the good and beautiful on earth, everywhere, always. The Catholicity of the church is not the same thing as the institution. We do not have to defend the institution and the people running her because we believe in and love the Catholicity of the church. Another thing is the Catholicity versus real local expression and local decision-making, subsidiarity in the church. We don't have to become a bunch of storefront of emergent churches to not just be another instantation, a cookie cutter of the thing. That's one thing that was kind of right about cultural Catholicism and like the ethnic parishes and stuff, is they could be completely different in some ways because it was who was there. The problem is that becomes a pattern that no one can get out of, and it doesn't matter who's there. And you can have people running a church who are like 2% of the church and the other 98% are someone else, and the church still runs as if the place is full of that 2%. That's wrong, and that's another podcast. Celibacy versus marriage. I talked about this a couple times ago. Just get over it. There are married priests. And I think, again, I will say that I think that what the church needs right now is some priests that people consider safe from this and are not tied to a suspicion of this. And the fastest way to do that would be to ordain married men. Because if he's just like some nice, normal, masculine dude who was in business for a while, and he got married and made some kids, and, you know, he's got a family and a wife, and, you know, plays basketball on the weekends, and now he's a priest, you might be thinking, well, I mean, did he get a good education? I mean, is he smart enough to kind of be preaching to us all the time or what? You might think different things about him, but one thing you're not going to be thinking about is, my son safe with him? Yes, let him take your son camping. 99% sure, if the dude is a nice, normal guy formed outside of a seminary, formed outside of any possible weirdness, and who is attracted to a woman who's made a bunch of babies with her, he's probably okay to go camping or to run the basketball team. Not always. It's like Aristotle said. It's true for the most part, but not in every instance. Right? He said that about nature. And I think that's true about this. But it would be, you'd have a much higher rate of real dudes with a firmly rooted masculine character behind the altar. I'm for it. I don't care. And it's funny. I've seen several people coming out since I did that podcast. I've seen priests on YouTube that are young, vibrant, solid priests that are real conservative. And they're like, look, I need to come out of the closet here. Based on why everything's going on, I'm going to come out of the closet. No, not that closet. My closet I'm coming out of is, I am pro married priesthood. And it's just time to talk about it. I've seen several people talking about that online. Another one is that there's somehow, I want to skip over those. Truth versus wonder. I'm going to skip right down to that. I'm running over. Truth versus wonder. I think that there's this idea that we have to like believe in this dogma and learn the answers and regurgitate them back and toe the line, versus having some kind of real supple wonder. There being a reality and a truth that can be understood inside your head, and having some kind of humility in front of the mystery are not contradictory. In fact, they are two halves of one coin. And I think, once again, breathing with both lungs, that's something that the East could help us with. It's also some of what our, if we would just go back in our own tradition, we could find. Now is a time to engage, encounter, and evolve. Not mutate, but evolve. It's time for us to engage, to look at the situation, to bring as many of these people forward who were hurt, rip the Band-Aid off, see the scars, love the living crap out of these people and take care of them. I don't care even financially. Take care of these people. Make amends. The church may have to learn how to tithe. And I've heard people say, well, I don't want to give. I don't want to give to the church. I give to this or this, because if I give to the church, they might just take my money and it's just going to go into those down the toilet and all them lawsuits. All these people that were abused by a priest are just going to take all our money. Right. As a Catholic, if someone trusted your priest and then was destroyed, and giving them some money might at least be a symbolic act of repentance and might help some kind of change in them and maybe help them deal with the needs they have that might have arisen from, you know, not being able to function as well as they would have if they didn't have that wound real early on. And maybe that's had even financial ramifications in their life. You should line up to do that. You should give extra for that. You should want to help. So we engage, and then we engage the structures. Yes, I don't want to use the words policies and procedures, but we need to engage deeper than policies and procedures. We need to engage the structures. We need to ask ourselves, is the way that we do church, the way that we train, the way that we pick, the way that we ordain, the way we do all this, is this a product of a former time that we didn't see coming, but some shifts that happened in Western culture or in modern culture combined to make a super toxic, weird environment, and they can't keep going? Maybe we need to train priests differently. Maybe we need to let different people be priests. Maybe we need to really engage on a fundamental level with a love and a belief that some things can't change, our dogma, but other things can. And the church has always changed where she can to meet the needs of the context with the truth of Christ. So it's time for us to do that. It's time for us to really engage and then to evolve, to move on and to, oh, and then the other, oh, I'm sorry, the other encounter part that I want to talk about, the encounter before the evolve encounter, we need to then enter into all this prayerfully in real, honest, engaging reality, letting experience it, seeing what it is, not trying to cover it with ideology, and in both real, honest reasonableness and prayer, look at it, acknowledge it, encounter God in the ashes, and repent and beg God to heal us and to inspire us and then trust us to move on and then act. That comes to the evolution part, to the part that we have to evolve. We may need to find some new ways to do things, which I talked about. We might need to find a new way to do the parish. We might need to find a new way to do church besides a parish. This hasn't all these things have not been the case forever and ever and ever. There's different ways of doing things. We kind of think that everything that has been done in America, as long as we can remember, is the way it's always been. But there are buildings in Europe that are three times older than our country. I know, I've drank coffee in them. I've seen me do it. And this hasn't always been this way. And there are other ways to do it. And there will be new ways to do it. And we need to beg God and ask him to help us with real ways to do it. Now, what happens that three E's, I accidentally came up with three E's, and then I came up with I wanted to talk about three R's that I've had as part of kind of the way I talk about things for a very long time, like the 91. what happens when you engage reality, you acknowledge it, you live with it, you see how bad it is, you encounter God in the ashes, and you repent, and then you move on. You have what I call three R's: the revival, renaissance, revolution. You have a revival when the people of God repent and they act on that repentance in real meaningful ways, and they beg God to visit his people. When they beg God, when they come before the living God and they beg God and they say, Lord God, come visit your people, and they really repent and they act on that repentance, not like in sackcloth and ashes and whipping themselves and doing a bunch of penance. I mean, they change. There's a priest one time, I've told this story here. I went into this confessional in a very liberal church in LA, doing my duty, just going to clock in, give him number and kind, clock out, and listen to bad advice that I was going to have to correct his theology, because I knew it was a very liberal parish. And I got this really young priest, and he's like, do you want to change? He was an Irish guy. Do you want to change your life? I'm like, hey, I was just here for the clock in. And now, dude, man. But the question is, do you want to change? Do we, the church, want to change? And there is the problem. We don't want to change because we think that the world is dogma. We think that all of reality is dogma and change is heresy. And we have built this whole damn thing not to change. We have built the Titanic to be unable to turn to make her safe. And now there's an iceberg and now we've hit it and there's no way to turn. So we need to go, okay, let's pluck everybody out of the water. Let's get some rescue boats, do whatever we can do. Let's bury the dead, pick the wounded up out of the water. Let's redesign the Titanic with a desire to not hit any more icebergs, to get where we're supposed to be going. Let's do that. So that's what happens. We have a revival. Then there's a renaissance. There's like, let's try some new stuff. Let's come up with stuff. Now, imbued by this right attitude, imbued by this new begging of God to be present with us, imbued by that activity, be imbued by that attitude, we seek God and we act. And when we act, we try things. We redesign. We beg God for new wine, and in faith that the new wine's going to come, we build new wineskins. But I know what you're saying. Oh, new wine, new wineskins. You sound like a liberal, Vatican II. I didn't say we're going to get wine. I didn't say we're going to get something other than wine. We're going to get wine. I didn't say we're going to get it from somewhere else. We're going to get it from God. And I didn't say we're going to get new bag in a box or new bottles. We're still getting wineskins. We're just getting new ones. They're still wineskins. I'm not asking for a complete and total change, but we need new wine and we need new wineskins, but we need the fresh wine from the source. That's what we need. And we need to act on faith and begin building these wineskins after we've repented, after we've acted, after we've begged God. We need to start building these wineskins and in faith that God is going to act. Hopefully I can help do some of those and keep a roof over my head. So engage, encounter, evolve, revival, renaissance, revolution. All right, introducing a new way to end the show. Are you ready? After all that, an hour and a half, I went way over. I'm just going to quit saying I'm going over. I don't care. I told them my show was going to be around an hour. Who cares? I'm going to do an hour and a half show sometimes. I'm going to do a 45-minute show sometimes. It's a podcast. It doesn't matter. I can do whatever I want. Two things. First of all, I want to talk about Sudoku. I know what you're thinking. Isn't that like math game? No. That's Sudoku. I don't know. This is with a T in front of it. This is Tsun. T-S-U-N-D-O-K-U. Sudoku, I guess it's pronounced. And it's glorious. I love when other cultures have a word for something that we really, really need in this. Like in German, there's a word, and I can't remember what it is, and it means a face begging to be slapped. There's literally like a, there's all these different words. I was just reading a Subornoster by Catherine Doherty, and she was trying to explain that, okay, it means this, but it's translated this, but it doesn't really mean this. It's hard to translate something like that, right? There's these words. Well, Sundoku is one of those words, and it's the practice of buying more books than you can read. The Japanese have a word for this. Oh, isn't this glorious? Even when reading is impossible, the presence of books acquired produces such an ecstasy that the buying of more books than one can read is nothing less than the soul reaching towards infinity. A. Edward Norton, author, publisher, and collector of 10,000 books. I have said before that it's not hoarding when it's books. And as someone who buys way more books than I read, it's, oh, sometimes I think it's a problem. It probably is a problem. It's definitely a problem. It's not a problem. No, it's a problem. It's really, it's not a problem. No, it really is. I admit it. It's, I have a problem. It's bad. I'm in the wrong here. No, I'm not. It's not a problem. Anyway, Sundoku. There you go. The second way, this is the final random thoughts, things that make you, why did he do that? No, these are just final random thoughts. Number one, Sundoku. God, I love that word. That's great. The second one is, heard this on the radio this week, thought it was a joke, looked it up. It's not. I had no idea. Male platypi, that's platypuses, male platypi are venomous. Thank you. Good night. I mean, I really wanted to just go. And now for a final thought. Male platypi are venomous. Thank you. Pull the plug and pop the cork. I just couldn't get myself to do it. It's like, so let's think about this. Platypus. It's a mammal with a duck's bill that lays eggs. And it's venomous. So it's like super cute. It's like Donald Duck and a beaver had a baby. Here it is. Oh, that's weird and messed up. You know God has a sense of humor. Just look at the platypus. Ah. And you know God has an angry side because this really cute platypus has a barb on its hind limb that injects a poison, a venom, mostly during mating season as basically a competition with other males. And its effect is not deadly, but has been described as quote unquote excruciatingly painful. Now, I've never met a platypus, but I want to be honest with you. I probably would have tried to pet one. I mean, they're cute. They're like a duck beaver. Come on. You got to love a duck beaver. You like duck beavers, don't you? Everybody likes duck beavers. I mean, it's a duck otters or whatever. It's a cute little cuddly thing with a bill that looks like Donald Duck. How can you not like that? It's friggin' venomous. There you go. So buying more books than you can read is reaching for my old stone. I'll take your place. Episode of The Counter Position. Thanks for coming out, kids.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.